You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Alla Fairberg.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. We've got a fantastic show for you today. But before we get into that, I'd like to tell you about a couple of sponsors who make the show possible each and every day. Craig Allinson has a brand new book. It's a spinoff of the Expeditionary Force series, Expeditionary Force Mavericks Book 1, Death Trap. The human soldiers stranded on the planet Paradise have been recruited into an alien legion to do the dirty jobs that the high-tech species won't do. Their first mission is to kick the enemy off a backwater planet no one cares about. It's a simple assignment, except everyone has a hidden agenda, and the planet could become a death trap. Craig Allinson's brand new book, Death Trap. Also thanks to Ernie Lindsay with his Sarah series, the psychological thriller series that begins with Sarah, has books 1-3 and a bonus novella, Single Mother, Successful Executive, Target for Revenge. The psychological thriller series box set, Sarah Winthrop's world is thrown headlong into a whirlwind of chaos along with her family, friends, and colleagues by unseen enemies seeking revenge. Those lurking in the shadows clawing for vengeance will go to any lengths. Any lengths. It's likely never occurred to them that they may have just messed with the wrong woman. The Sarah series. Books 1-3 and a bonus novella by Ernie Lindsay. Also, John L. Monk with The Jenkins Cycle. From Book 1, Kick, a supernatural thriller. They say suicides are damned for eternity, but if possessing the bodies of violent criminals is hell, then Dan Jenkins will take it. And he does. Every time a portal arrives to whisk him from his ghostly exile. Normally, before the villain returns to kick him out, Dan dishes out a final serving of justice and leaves the world a safer place. It's one of the rules if he wants more rides, and he's happy to oblige. For a part-time dead guy, it's a pretty good gig. And then he meets her. Kick is the first book in a series of supernatural thrillers. If you like Quantum Leap and Everyday, you'll love this gritty and original take on the body-hopping hero story. Vividly written, Kick is a wild ride with a sharp, sarcastic wit and a flawed, yet likable main character. From John L. Monk, The Jenkins Cycle, Book 1, Kick. And from M.D. Massey, Invasion, Zombie Apocalypse. The action-packed first novel in M.D. Massey's Them Zombie Apocalypse series. When a surprise nuclear attack forces Aiden from hiding, he finds the world to be a much different place and more deadly. Now he'll traverse a post-apocalyptic landscape populated by violent redneck looters, rogue military factions, and an army of hungry undead. After two combat tours in the Middle East, Aiden Sullivan just wants to be left alone on his family's ranch in the Texas Hill Country. But when the bombs fall and the dead walk, Aiden risks life and limb to rescue his aging parents from the zombie horde. To save them, he'll traverse half the state of Texas while fighting rogue military units, violent redneck looters, and thousands of walking dead. The question is, can he make it there in time? Only one thing's for sure, this ranger will complete the mission or he'll die trying. M.D. Massey's Invasion, Zombie Apocalypse. Now on to our show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Eugenia West on the show with me today. She has a fantastic new book called Sarah's War, and it's out available now when you're hearing this. Welcome to the show, Eugenia.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to this.
Well, thank you. I'm excited to have you on the show today. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, I think I always liked to play with words, but I never started seriously writing until my youngest child was in school all day. And I started out really as a freelance reporter for local papers. And I would dash around with my Nikon, you know, feeling very important, covering everything from the sewage disposal meeting to actually a national convention. But I think with a lot of journalists, 300 words, you think, maybe that could be 300 pages. And my first novel was absolute trash, terrible, terrible.
As most of ours are.
Yeah, I think journalism is wonderful training. You do learn to cut down the adjectives and the adverbs, but you get this urge, you know, maybe I could do more. So I did do the first novel, but that was bad. But the second one got me a contract with Doubleday and Ballantine. So Mother's little hobby became, Mum's an author now. She can write author in those awful blanks where you have to fill in what your profession is.
Right. Oh man. I've talked to quite a few journalist turned novelist. And, one thing I love to ask people is, do you feel like your time as a journalist, helped you to look at the world differently? I always think of journalist as being the person, on the scene who tries to get, the take on a story that the rest of us don't see, or maybe another journalist doesn't get. Do you feel like that those skills translate well to being a novelist?
I think the process helps you enormously, but I think the big difference is that the journalist, you have to be so careful checking your facts. Don't get anything wrong. Whereas when you're a novelist, you can just let your imagination soar. You aren't bound by, you know, protocol. So I think that was the big difference for me.
Right. So you decided to try your hand at writing fiction, and that turned into a writing career. What were the types of books that you began writing?
Well, the first one was historical suspense. Set in Jamaica, West Indies, a sugar plantation, and that was my first. That was the historical, but I always loved those golden age mystery writers like Dorothy Sayers and P.D. James a little later. So. I switched to the mystery genre, which was probably a bit of a mistake to switch genres, but I did. And so then again, a whole new set of rules, you know, drop the red herring, the clue, the villain has to be a surprise at the end. The first one was self-published for friends and family, but then I entered a contest put on by St. Martin's Press called Malice Domestic, and didn't think much more about it until one morning I sat down at my computer, opened it up, and there was an offer from St. Martin's wonderful Grand Dame, mystery editor Ruth Cavan, offering me a contract for two mysteries. Well, you can imagine, as a writer, it doesn't get any better than that.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, it was absolutely fantastic. I levitated out of my chair. So that took up, a few years. But there was always in the back of my mind this historical novel sort of little boiling away a little bit. So my last effort has Sarah's War, which is historical, set in the American Revolution, and an absolutely fascinating period, which I think has come to people's attention a lot because of Hamilton. And so now I'm back. Now I'm back in the history mode. And heck, I don't know whether you know, but I am 96 years old.
Oh my goodness! I had no idea. That is amazing.
Well, that I think that's the most. I think that's the most probably most interesting thing that I can tell you, because I think it does give encouragement to younger writers and younger people that are, and I envy them a little bit because they've got time to play around with genres, you know, experiment a little bit. But you know, at 96, that's every day is sort of a gift.
Absolutely. You know, I talk to writers all the time who maybe begin their writing in their 40s or so, and they feel like, oh, I've got so much that I want to do, and I'm starting so late in life, and you are an absolute inspiration for that. Absolutely. So, how long have you been writing fiction?
Well, since I was in my 40s, so the starting with Ancestors Cry Out, the historical novel set in Jamaica. So I've been writing for quite a while.
That is amazing. What is it about historical fiction that you love so much? And what was it about the time period and the place of Jamaica and the sugar plantations that really caught your imagination?
Well, to go back, I loved Jamaica. I had family down there. We're talking back in the 50s, before Jamaica became a tourist place, and life was pretty simple then. But it was it's such a beautiful place. But Sarah's War, I think, was triggered off because I was reading somebody else's history, and they were talking about the winter of 1777, which was very pivotal in the war for independence, because Washington was at Valley Forge, you know, bleeding feet in the snow, troops, poor little militia, deserting, sick, desperation. And meanwhile, in Philadelphia, in winter quarters, here were the British officers living it up. You wouldn't believe the entertainments they provided for themselves, turning the heads of the little loyalist girls like Peggy Shippen. And the contrast was so incredible that I started out and I did a great deal of research. And I see a little bit of a parallel, too, with what we're going through today, a little bit of chaos. I mean, a lot of chaos then, much more. you realize that those patriots laid the foundations for something very important, our democracy. And I try to give a feeling of what it was like to live in those days. Very dangerous.
Well, a few years ago, I read David McCullough's fantastic book, 1776. And it really, he followed, he led us through that whole year, and all of the trials and tribulations that the patriots were going through. And, you know, it's a shame that when we're talking about American history, things get condensed to bullet points. And we talk a lot about that on the show, and it's one reason that I love historical fiction. I think it's so important, is it gives humanity back to these events. and allows us to see what was going on through a character who we can relate to, you know, from their perspective. But so often we think 1776, the Declaration of Independence, and everything was just wonderful then. No, that was just the beginning of hardships. And your book takes place in 1777, as you said. How do you start, looking for the things that are really going to make the reader engage with what's going on? How do you start looking for source information and research for a book like this?
Well, I think for me, it starts with the character. And my character, Sarah, is a young girl from a small village in Connecticut who goes to help an aunt whom she expects to be a needy aunt in Philadelphia, and finds that the aunt is a rich loyalist, and Sarah is plunged into a life of intrigue and treachery and heartbreak. So to answer it a little bit, condensed a little bit, it has to start with a character, because I'm not a historian. I mean, I think of myself as a storyteller. I'm not a trained historian like David McCullough. So, but I did do a lot of research, which it pained me to cut it out, because I spent 4 days standing on, you know, on the banks of the Brandywine River. I could have told you where, at the Battle of Brandywine, where every troop stood, and, you know, the surprise march, the beginning of George Washington's, his need for good intelligence. But I had to cut a lot of that out. But, so I think Sarah's Word is kind of a combination of a mystery and a romance, and it moves very fast. It's not a large book. It's history light a little bit, but compared to David McCullough.
Yeah. Well, tell us about Sarah. How did this character come to you, and what is her journey?
Well, her journey is it's finding her strengths, really. I tend to end up with strong women working their way through problems, and she goes to Valley Forge to help help in the plot against George Washington's life, and she is turned from a country girl, wearing homespun dresses, and into a leading belle among the British officers, and she actually marries one of them, who dies at the Battle of Monmouth, another major battle, and ends up with a captain in Washington's intelligence service that she's had an up and down relationship with, you know, and but in the end her goal is to help create a new independent nation, and Sarah, you live with these people, Hank, as you know yourself, being a writer, and they become more real to you than
they do.
My own children, so Sarah's very real to me. I love her very much.
How long did you work on this book?
Off and on for quite a few years, because I started it, then I put it down, then I picked it up, then I put it down and condensed it, revised it. So quite a long time, actually.
I have to ask you this, since you have had such a long writing career, how has your writing process changed through the years?
Well, I think you start by having to find your voice, which takes quite a lot of time. My theory is that writing is 20%, well, let's even say 10% talent and 90% applying the seat of the pants to the seat of the chair. I don't write quickly. I do an awful lot of revising, which means that my output has not been huge at all. But on the other hand, Hank, I've been very lucky. I was married to a successful businessman, so I didn't have to have a second job. I was able to bring up my four children and in comfort, and I consider myself very lucky that way.
When a lot of times when we start writing, we're looking for that voice, and you talked about how important it was to find your voice, and a lot of times we'll begin by mimicking our influences and using things that we've picked up from a lifetime of reading. How do you know when you found your voice and when you graduate from merely imitating the things that you love and the writers that you love and finding what it is that is your true voice?
I'm not sure you ever do. I think I could probably improve on what my voice is now.
It's an ever-changing, growing thing, isn't it?
I think it's an ever-changing. It helps. I think that journalism helps you find that. I think you by reading and thinking about writers that you admire. Maybe you pick up a little bit of their style from the ones that you truly admire, but it's a tricky thing finding your voice.
Right. How has the technology of writing changed in your writing career?
Oh my goodness! When I started out, writers pretty much were dependent on having an agent and a publisher. There wasn't much in the way of self-publishing, and that has changed so much for the better. And of course, there was no social media. There was not even, you know, this is, you know, I hate to play the old age card, but there weren't even computers when I started. You had the old typewriter going and using the whiteout. So believe me, publishing has changed, but, I think it gives more opportunity to writers to get started. They have more venues to explore.
When you begin a book like Sarah's War, and you said that it always begins with character, what's the planning stage of a book like? Do you get to know the character? Do you then start looking at the setting? How do you go about gathering the things that you're going to need? And do you outline before you start writing?
I'm sort of middle road. My first mystery novel, I realized when I got to the end that I really I didn't quite remember who the villain was. I couldn't, and believe me, I never made that mistake again. So now I know how the ending. I know how the ending is going to, how it's going to end, and how it's going to start. And I know some writers have elaborate outlines and go chapter by chapter by chapter. Well, I don't do that, but and you learn a few little tricks. Mine is I don't have writer's block, but if I get to a place where I'm just a little bit not sure which way to go, I take a piece of paper and I put at the top, what if? And then I give three or four different solutions. And somehow that sort of frees up your, you can then, and you can sort of move forward. So that's something I do. I think writers are apt to live in two worlds. You know, the world that you sleep and eat and talk to your friends and whatnot, and then the world that you're inhabiting with your creations. I don't know that you find that, but
sure.
But I think that's, and because you're living in that world, it doesn't leave you. So sometimes you're just walking down the hall or something, and you'll have a night, something will, a little light will bulb will go off in your head about something, and or at night, you know, you have a piece of paper and I can write down what I'm thinking. So it's with you. You're developing book all the time.
Writing is the only profession that you can get away with saying that you were talking with the voices in your head, and people, you know, forgive that and don't give you a second look.
Well, I'm not talking out. I'm not sort of going down the hall. Talking out loud. It's in my head.
I haven't quite
got to that point yet, But you know what I mean. You're living in two different atmospheres.
Yeah, you are. When writing a book that's based in a historical time period, and something that you know, situations and settings that we know about, maybe not intimately, but are familiar with, what are some things that you do to keep the story moving along and to keep the drama and keep it entertaining without bogging down in too many facts? We talked earlier mm-hmm. about doing the research to make it believable, but how do you balance that with making it an entertaining read that doesn't distract the writer with the other things going on?
Well, I think what I do best is dialogue, and I'm a great believer in dialogue for moving the plot along without a lot of explanation. And my books are very dialogue oriented, and I try to throw in what they call the divine detail, you know, that little detail that brings it a little bit to life. I definitely stay away from long descriptions, but to me, dialogue is key when you're writing a novel.
The new book is Sarah's War. It's available everywhere when you're hearing this. Eugenia, at the end of this book, when people close it and they finish with it, what do you hope readers take away from this story?
I hope they come away with a feeling of gratitude towards our founders, people, and that persevered through tremendously dangerous times, and formed a democracy, and that's what I truly, truly hope. But I hope they've been diverted. I hope they've been plunged into that world, the way people dressed, the way they talked. And I'm a huge believer in escape reading. I think escape reading is terribly important, and that's what I want to immerse my readers into another world of interesting people and events. I think that's really my goal. If somebody tells me that they they stayed up too late and they lost sleep because of one of my books. I am overjoyed. That's my reward.
Well, there's no better compliment than someone losing sleep because of your writing. That is for sure. Eugenia, I know that you have a fantastic website. If people are just learning about you and want to connect with you more and find out about news of what's going on, where can they find you and where can they connect with you?
Well, I think at the moment my website is really the EugeniaLoveAtWest.com is the best way. I haven't done what I should have done, been doing for years, you know, developing a great blog presence, and I may do a little more of that, but I guess the website is, and I'm always happy to connect with people. I love hearing their stories.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to put links to that in the show notes, and we'll send everyone to see you. Eugenia, it's been so much fun talking today. The book, again, is Sarah's War. It's available everywhere now. We're going to send everybody to see you. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
Well, thank you, Hank. I truly enjoyed it. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I wish you all kinds of good luck in your work.
Thank you, and you as well. Stay tuned now for the second part of this special doubleheader episode and our interview with Diane Wald. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Diane Wald on the show with me today. She has a brand new book called Gillyflower, and I think you guys are really going to love this book. Welcome to the show, Diane.
Thank you so much.
Diane, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
That would be a very early memory. My parents were not big readers themselves, but for some reason, my mother bought me a lot of books. I think she enjoyed them as much as I did, and so she would read them to me, and I became, these just became beloved books for me, all these childhood stories, and I think I began to see life itself as a story. I loved it so much that I figured out how to read before I went to school. So I think I was a bit of a pain in the neck to my parents after that.
Give her a book. She'll be quiet for a few minutes.
Give her a book. She'll shut up for a while. But I also, looking back after years of studying writing, it made me realize that these very early books gave me an understanding of metaphor, which is critical, and an appreciation of language. You know, the language could be fancy, it could be plain, it could be funny. So all those things, I think I really got them from those early books. There was one especially an anthology called The Tall Book of Make-Believe that I think if people are old enough, they might have had it when they were kids too. And it had wonderful writers in it, Carl Sandburg and all these famous writers, and it had a couple of especially crazy stories in it. Like there was a story about a bunch of little kids who were very rambunctious, and one of the little boys pulled a little girl under a door. Of course, this couldn't happen, but in the book, he pulled her under the door and she came out flat. She was fine, but she was flat, and so she couldn't eat any round food, and she couldn't talk about anything that was round. And I was just entranced by stories like that, you know. So I think, you know, I had this early desire to make them up myself.
So it sounds to me like you really connected with fantasy in a way earlier. Just the taking of the natural world and putting it in fantastical situations.
Yes, I think that's really true. You know that I loved reading things that made life sort of dreamy and made everything possible. There was another one, just quickly, there was another one that I remember, a book called A Lemon and a Star. And the little girl in that book had something terrible happen to her. I don't remember what it was, but she was in a lot of mental pain. She was hurt by someone. And I remember there was this description of her eating dinner and how she was thinking that, well, I have this pain inside me. It's like a hole. So if I eat this potato soup, it will start to fill up the hole. And then I'll put some bread on top of that and it'll be softer and it won't hurt as much. And she went through the whole meal like that, you know. So it was very, very visual images, and the images were wonderful.
Well, and that's a great way for a kid to start conceptualizing metaphor.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Which has served you well ever since.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, no one ever told me what it was until I was quite a lot older, but
right.
That's what it was.
Right. But the idea that, that there's a thing and I'm going to use this other thing to try to fill that. And, that's really loaded imagery, you know, for a kid.
Isn't it? Yeah. They were great books.
That's fantastic. At what point did you start thinking that maybe you could tell stories yourself?
I was pretty young. I have a brother, but he's 5 years younger than I was. And so I was kind of a solitary child for a while. And when I went to school, I was 5 years old. And there was a writing class. I remember this distinctly because I was so proud of myself. We had to write a paragraph. They told us to write a paragraph about spring. And I imagine that all the other kids were writing about, you know, the birds and the grass and all of that. And I wrote it as if I were a squirrel, like from the point of view of a squirrel. And I remember the teacher going crazy because, you know, she never imagined that anybody would do that. And from then on, it was so funny. All the other kids, every time they had to write something, wrote it from the point of view of something else. So I had a very inflated idea of how successful I could be at this game of writing. So it was pretty early.
You also have a love of poetry. When did you fall in love with poetry?
Well, I was writing some poetry in high school, but I don't think it was encouraged. I was reading a lot of poetry. And then I went to college and lucked out because I went to a teacher's college and you were supposed to, the reason I went there was not because I wanted necessarily to be a teacher, but was the college we could afford at that time. My father had passed away when I was a senior in high school, and you know, I think I only applied to two colleges because I really was a mess, and went to this teacher's college, and they said, well, you can't take this creative writing course. That's not on your schedule. You can't take that. And I thought, well, yes, I can. So I just showed up. I just showed up, and I found out where it was. I showed up in the class, and thank God I did that because I met this teacher. His name was Bill Dell, and he was a poet himself. But he was also this very intuitive kind of teacher who, you know, he didn't just give the whole class the same assignment. He was very interested in people's personalities and what they were good at. And he didn't try to, I was kind of the shy, retiring type at the time, and he didn't try to force me to do things or try to force me to talk in class if I didn't want to. And gradually, I just sort of blossomed. And they also, because of him, in this little New Jersey teacher's college, had the most incredible collection of contemporary poets in the library. And so I would just go in there and lose myself among all the books there. And that was the beginning of my poetry career.
You have pursued that throughout the years. How do you feel that poetry is, do you feel like that there's a place for poetry in the mainstream? That's the wrong question. It seems like people overlook poetry to our you know, all great detriment. But how can we bring poetry more into the mainstream, maybe, is what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah. You know, I think it's getting better and better and better. Years ago, people didn't, there's a joke among poets that the only people who read poetry are poets, and we all read each other's books and pat each other on the back and all that. But now I think there are a lot of things going on. One is all the amazing songwriters, like Leonard Cohen, for example. You know, people love Leonard Cohen and loved him until the day that he passed away, and they love him even now, and they maybe don't realize it, but his songs are poetry. They're excellent poetry, most of them. And so there are all these great songwriters out there that are very popular. And I understand that there are now Instagram poets, and, you know, people are getting very creative about it. And I think there's not so much fear attached to the word, you know. Poetry was for a long time just something that you didn't really want to even talk about. You know, if somebody said to you, well, oh, I see you published a book, and you'd say, yes, it's a volume of poetry. And they'd say, yeah, and it's a really nice day out today, too. So, you know, they just don't know how to react to it. But I think it's getting better.
Well, what's so weird is, and Leonard Cohen is a perfect example, we all love songwriting. We love that a song can capture us in, you know, 3.5 minutes and tell us an entire story and take us on an entire emotional journey. And we don't realize that there's an art form to that that's been going on for, you know, millennia. I'm glad to know that that people are making the connection, and it's coming, more to people's, to the forefront of their, you know, thinking.
Yeah, I think that's happening in schools too. I think that teachers and professors are making that connection, and that, so it's getting more popularized.
That's great. As someone who also writes longer form fiction, how do you feel like poetry affects your novel writing, your fiction writing?
Oh, I think a lot. Because in this book, particularly in Gillyflower, because again, I was very conscious of the language itself. I mean, I don't know how many times I revised this book. It's hilarious, really, like over and over and over, because I wanted every sentence to have the kind of language and the kind of movement that I would get in poetry. You know, it certainly doesn't come across the same way, but I wanted it to have that quality of importance. It's a fairly short book, and so that even made it more critical that everything was important in the book. And the other, I think, is what I mentioned before, just the idea of metaphor, that the characters in the book are very conscious of things that they can't see necessarily in life, things that are going on all around them that they can't put their finger on, but they are acting and speaking in ways that describe those things, and they're using metaphors for it. You know, I don't want to give anything away about the book, but there's a metaphor. One of the main characters has a habit of wearing blue gloves all the time, and he's a bit of a dandy. And those blue gloves go throughout the narrative and end up in the very last scene of the book. So there are a lot of things like that I was very aware of.
Well, tell us, where did Gillyflower come from? How did this story start taking shape in you?
I don't know. The word, I had heard the word somewhere before.
Yeah.
A long time ago, and I'm really interested in gardening, flowers, and everything. So it kind of stuck in my mind as an attractive word. And when I was writing the book, and it just kind of popped into my head as a good image for what I was trying to convey. And it's also, if you Googled Gillyflower, you'd get like 10 million pictures of flowers, and they don't really look that much alike, but they all have a very vague similarity to what I think in America we would call a carnation.
Okay.
They're like tiny carnations with maybe not as many petals as your average carnation. And they come in specific kinds of colors, and they're mostly found, at least the ones that I, you know, fastened on, were mostly found in Europe. So that fit right into the story. And it also, it has a great sound. I love the sound of that word. And so when one of the characters says, you're like a little gillyflower, it just sounded good to me.
So when a story starts taking shape for you, what comes first? Is it a character? Is it a setting? Is it a word like gillyflower that then starts growing and bringing shape inside your mind? How does the process usually start for you?
I think I would have to say it starts with the characters. Especially in this book, there are only four characters in the book. It's told from the point of view of each of the four characters. So there's one very sort of simple story, and each of the characters tells it in a different way. And pardon me, I was interested in developing those characters to the point that the story would take off, so that the reader would come away not with a disjointed picture of the story, but thinking like, wow, this is, you know, this is how this one reacted, this is how the other one reacted, and this is what I see as having actually happened in the book. And I haven't written a lot of fiction. This was really, I went sort of off the poetic path with this one, and I had written one other long novel that I think I'll go back to someday. But again, it was inspired by a character, and I changed the character. The character in that book is a man who can memorize books. The person it's based on really didn't do that, but you know, it was interesting in that way. And so that book is based around his character.
So in this book, you play with that idea that we talked about earlier, the idea of the fantastical in the everyday, you know, everyday magic, I think is one way that you put it in the description. What was the draw to come back to this kind of fantastical, extraordinary day?
Well, I think it isn't extraordinary. I think it's ordinary, and we just don't realize all the things that are happening all the time that we can take advantage of. And the lead female character in the book, sort of without thinking about it, is that kind of person. She believes in nothing, but she believes in everything all at the same time. And so when something seems right to her, she follows it, and she does what she thinks she ought to be doing without worrying about, you know, does this seem strange? Are people going to think this is weird? She's not really worrying about that. And because of that quality, which is a great gift, I think, because of that quality, she is able to, by the end of the book, really become her true self.
Wow. When the story started taking shape for you, and you said normally a character comes to you, what was the process of discovering the story? Did you discover it as you started writing it? Did you conceptualize it before starting and had a plan? How did it start coming together for you?
all those things kind of happen at once, but I think mostly I was interested in the idea of obsession and how people deal with that and what good it is. You know, like if someone says, oh, well, you're obsessed with this or you're obsessed with that, it usually has a pejorative shadow cast over it. But I don't think that's necessarily always true. And in this case, the young woman has a bit of an obsession, but she uses it creatively. And I was interested in how a character like that would communicate and react with a character who was just the opposite, someone who was, you know, bound to the everyday life and didn't really give a lot of thought to things that were strange or confusing. And so when they get together, there's a lot of electricity and things happening, and I think they both change, those characters. And I based it on not the exact story in the book by any means. You know, people who have read it before publication have said to me, "Well, my God, did this happen to you? How come you didn't tell me about this?" And it didn't happen to me. I mean, I wish it had. It's kind of exciting, but it didn't happen to me. But something like that happened to me a long, long time ago, and I wanted to explore it through these characters.
The narrative structure of the book is really fun, in that you tell the story from four different people's perspective. What was the decision to do that? How did you decide to present the book in that way?
I just thought it would give me a lot of power, because, you know, I could have told it in the third person and had the same kind of power, but I don't think it would have drawn people in the same way as it does when you get a character speaking in first person. And some of the characters, their descriptions of the very same event are not quite the same, you know.
Right.
And so you begin to wonder, wait a minute, you know, what really happened here? And so the reader has to make a lot of decisions. And I think unless you've got a story that the reader has to do some work on, you know, they're going to get bored. So you don't want to tell them everything. And I think by having the various stories told from different points of view, I was able to engage people more, or at least I hope so. And also, it enabled me to give a lot of backstory, especially on the two main characters.
Well, and it allows you to play with the idea of an untrustworthy narrator, because people see things differently, and you get to kind of play with the reader a little bit in, you know, is this really what happened? And then allow the reader to kind of get into the story and start trying to find the truth for themselves, which is always fun to do.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's what I was hoping.
Yeah. You said that there was an experience that you had that you wanted to play with in this book. What happened to you?
Well, I'll never really tell, but it was an interpersonal connection with someone that was, gosh, I'm trying to think of how to tell this without giving away too much of the book, but Nora and Hugh in the book, the two main characters, have a very mystical kind of connection. They don't, at the beginning of the book, they don't know each other. They wouldn't know each other if they fell over each other. And, yet there's something going on there that eventually brings them together. And that's the kind of thing that happened to me. It was not, you know, by any means as dramatic as anything that happened in the book, but it just planted a seed in my mind, because I think that happens a lot. And if people are open to it and you know, follow their stars, so to speak, a lot of interesting things can happen.
Right. You said a minute ago that it's really not extraordinary, that things happen all around us if we would just pay attention. Do you feel like being a writer helps you to see the you know, the strange in the everyday?
Yeah, I think so. I think after all these years, it does help, because you're attuned to details. And details, I didn't talk about this before, but that's another important thing, I think, that carried over from poetry. Poetry has, or mine did anyway, had tons and tons of sensory details in it, right? But it doesn't necessarily paint a picture, a global picture. So in this book, after it was long after I wrote it and read it again, actually, that I realized the same thing was happening. There were lots of descriptions of what was of the characters and the scenes and all of that, but there was very little scene setting in terms of the world. You know, when she goes into a hotel, there are very distinct descriptions of what happens directly to her and directly to the other main character, but there's not a big description of the hotel and the street outside and all this other stuff. So it becomes very focused on the story. And that's probably why the book is short also. It's a novella, really.
Right, right. We talked about how writing poetry helps, you know, in writing fiction. But how is writing fiction different than writing poetry? And does the longer format allow you to do different things, to use different tools in storytelling?
Yeah, it does. And it took me a really long time to appreciate that, I think. My husband is a really great fiction writer. And, you know, I would watch him for years just go into his room and close the door and type away for hours and hours. And that wasn't the way that I wrote poetry. I didn't really get it, what the happiness was in putting yourself in a room and typing for hours and hours. But now I do, because it frees you up to explore things in a more, I want to say, human way. I mean, in an everyday way, so that, you know, people don't go around, maybe the ancient Greeks did, but they don't now. People don't now go around spouting poetry at each other. it's not an opera. You know, life is not an opera, but life is more like a television show. And so you're able to have dialogue, which, you know, I almost never had in poetry. And dialogue was like a revelation to me. So much fun. And so I started listening to people more to find out, you know, to figure out what exactly they were saying, why they were saying things the way they were saying them. And that was really fascinating.
Diane, when someone gets to the end of Gillyflower and they've taken this journey with you, what do you hope they take away from the book?
I hope that they feel surprised, and that's a good thing. You know, that they feel that maybe this story didn't turn out the way they thought it would, but that's interesting, and that's another possibility for life in general. That, you know, it's kind of like be careful what you ask for kind of thing. So I hope that's there, and I hope that they also have a sense of the characters changing in a positive direction. Like, I think the main male character really has to think about himself in a different way now. You know, he's older and he's not going to live forever. And he's in the very last scene, he's beginning to mull over all these things.
The book is Gillyflower. It's out, available everywhere now. When you're hearing this, in paperback and Kindle edition, Diane, if people are just discovering you and your work, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
Yeah. On Twitter, I'm Sleep Arena. It's SLEEPERINA. And the website for the book is gillyflowernovel.com.
Excellent. We're going to send everyone to pick up their copy of Gillyflower. Diane, this has been so much fun chatting. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
Thank you. It was an honor.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
Seven men ran the farce. The seven witch hunters, the court of Oyer and Terminer. They tortured and lied and mutilated and murdered. they knew those women up in Salem Village were no witches. Their true target was the coven hidden in their own midst here in Salem Town. They meant to hang the innocent until the sisters surrendered. Did they surrender? Said Jason. No. Was that the wrong decision? To let innocent women die and save themselves? What do you think? Should the coven have fought openly? Created more hysteria by swooping in on broomsticks and casting spells over Salem? Should they have killed the judges? There are no right decisions. That is the horror of a witch hunt. Everything you do condemns you. Question the judge, thou art a defiant witch. Question his laws, you question the king, and thou art a treasonous witch. Question his superstitions, you question scripture, and thou art a blasphemous witch. Pity the condemned, you pity witches, and thy Christian mercy proves thy collusion with Satan. Witch hunters are not just bad lawyers practicing bad law. They are men who place the ends before the means. They choose their victim, a man, a woman, an entire race, and mark them for extinction. All evidence is damning evidence. All associations are damning associations. All infractions, and who among us is without sin, are unforgivable infractions. Their own failings and abuses of power are shrugged away as mere vigor in pursuit of the public good. A witch hunter will have you by whatever means necessary. If he cannot find evidence, he will create evidence. He will entrap you and question you and distort what you say. He will walk you through the night until your feet bleed, strip you and stripe you, dress you in your own filth until you forget you are human. He will torture your friends until they betray you. And if anyone dares to weep at your hanging, he will drag them to Gallows Hill in the back of the next ox cart. Any man can be a witch hunter. All it takes is hatred and arrogance and the preening self-regard that proclaims, my deeds are always good because they are my deeds. The seven judges of the Salem court were such men. But one witch stood up to them. She stood up to centuries of unchallenged murderous dogma and pronounced the magic word, no. They burned her for it.